We are live.
We are live.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Tech Days Online, day two, where we're talking about DevOps. I'm Marcus Robinson, technical evangelist here at Microsoft in the UK. Just to remind you, please do tweet with the hashtag Tech Days if you have any questions about anything we're discussing today. Now with me I have Simon Sabin from Sabin.io, who's going to talk about data and DevOps. He'll introduce this session.
Yeah, so what I find is that I speak to a lot of people about DevOps, and almost all the time what I find is people say, oh, the database part is impossible, it's hard, it's the difficult thing. They're fine about developing their code and deploying their code, but what they find is that doing that database part, it's like you always have these meetups and someone's doing this great thing about deploying web apps, and someone asks the question, what about database?
What about the data? I've heard it many a time.
And the guy at the front goes, it's a bit like that builder that comes around your house and looks at...
I don't do databases. That's somebody else's job.
Yes.
Your job.
Absolutely. And I've been doing this stuff for 20 years, and not under the DevOps banner, but I hate doing things twice. Automation and making it seamless is what I've been doing for many years. So hopefully in this session, we'll show you what's possible. We won't go into too many details, but we'll show you that it is possible, and with a bit of care and thinking about how you manage that change, we can show you how you can deploy your database changes with keeping your systems online and doing it in a DevOps way. I'm Simon Sabin, as you said. I'm a Microsoft Certified Master, Regional Director, MVP. I also founded SQLBits. If you've got any questions that you think of after the event, then email me, email's there, or tweet hashtag Tech Days, and one of the guys in the back will be able to help answer your question. So I think we've had a load of sessions today about DevOps, and I think the DBA guy sitting there is very reluctant to change. Yeah, they don't like this automation stuff. And they always think, oh, I don't want people making changes to my databases, because they have fear, because it's the data, it's the crown jewels of the business. And I've heard stories that when the World Trade Center went down, it wasn't problems with the fact that lots of people died, unfortunately, but it was more things like data centers and the data in there, the businesses that had the data in there, and they lost it. The businesses went kaput. And so that's why DBAs are really, they often think they're the guardians of the data. A bit like the infrastructure network guys feel like they're the guardians of the network. But I think in a DevOps world, we've got to break that down. And so some of the reasons that I think DevOps works really well, and why these are sort of the points that I think help a DBA understand why it's a good thing, in that if you're doing a small change, small risk. And if you do a big change, and we've all been there working the weekends when someone's tried to do this massive deployment and invariably it goes wrong, and there are always problems. If you do a small change, it reduces your risk. The more frequent you're doing things, then the more familiarity you get, and so again,
I'm starting to notice a pattern.
Yes. They're all about reducing risk. Now, they have other business consequences in that DevOps means you can do things faster, but I think from a DBA, all these things help reduce risk. And one of the things that I like to point out is when it doesn't work. I think with often these processes, it's great following them, but if you don't follow some of the things, it can make all the great effort you've put into this, the one side of it, fail because you're just doing one thing over here. Have you read the Phoenix Project?
I have read the Phoenix Project.
So the Phoenix Project is all about automating the system as a whole. It might be fantastic having this automation and these amazing systems producing widgets, but if they get stuck at a machine that can't deploy them, so if you've got a release and you've got all your code releasing really well but your database isn't, then everything is going to be held up by that database change.
Lowest common denominator.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you've got to invest in the whole end-to-end system thinking approach. And a big part of that is making teams own the change. I think too often we end up with a situation where we have a pipeline like this. We end up with DBAs are they want to make sure that things are okay, and so they want to review things, they want to manage that change. But it's a real blocker to the process. And what that means is that unless you can take them out of that as a gate, you're not going to get your end-to-end process working really well. So, and really, having if you look back at this slide, you've got the DBA in a number of points in that process. And the unfortunate thing is, you generally have more developers than you do DBAs, if you have any DBA at all. I mean, I've worked in many places where you've got 50 developers and you just don't have any DBAs. Yep. And they all shy away from the database thing. And it's like, it's almost like the poison chalice. It's like, you're going to do the database thing today.
Do you know some SQL?
Yes. Yeah. It's like, interview question, no SQL. Ah, we'll take you on board. And so having developers understand and own this. And I think the thing I find about developers is they're quite willing to just throw their arm into anything if they can understand it and manage it. And hopefully we can show you what's possible. And also want to point out, I don't think the database is any different to any of the sort of service architectures you talk about nowadays, so all the microservice buzzword stuff. They're there to help manage change and help manage contracts and interfaces. If you think about your database as this microservice, you can help solve a lot of your problems. So yeah, without a roadblock, you get your lovely continuous delivery process. And so automation really is essential for continuous delivery. And the options for making your database change, really, you've got two real ways of doing it. You can do the sort of migrations approach, which is essentially, if you're writing a change, you write a bit of SQL to go and add a column, change a stored procedure, and then you check that into source control, and then I make a change, and so every developer essentially codes all their changes. Now, that becomes quite challenging when you need to, I don't know, alter a column, and that has a dependency on a foreign key. You've also got to drop the foreign key, alter the column, add the foreign key back. Indexes, if you need to go and add an index, you've got to go and, or if you've got to go and change index, you've got to know whether it exists or not exists. And so some of those scripts can become complicated, but as a simple way of getting a database deployed, migrations is the easiest thing. The next step, and this is where a lot of people sort of have the nirvana, is what people call a gold schema. And I mean, some of the guys have been talking about desired state configuration. I mean, desired state configuration and a database and a gold schema is essentially that. You say, this is my schema, I want my schema to look like this, and then you go and give it to a tool, a bit like PowerShell DSE, but this is for databases, that takes that and goes, okay, well, the difference between what there is there and what I've got in my script is X, and that's the change I'm going to make. And then once you go beyond that, you end up with a hybrid approach. And almost every single scenario I've worked in, you need to have a hybrid approach, because some things just aren't possible in a gold schema. You need some sort of procedural, do this, then do that, then do the other type approach. And so you end up with this combined gold schema, hybrid approach.
I guess sometimes, although you're applying the new schema, the data might need manipulating to fit in with that.
Absolutely. Data movement is one of the biggest challenges. If you look at the tools, the simplest thing that you can do is just a bunch of scripts. Back in 20 years ago when I was writing database changes, I ended up having lots of text files sitting in a folder and an ADO.NET VB6 app that would loop through a folder and just go and, based on the date of the file, had a table. If my script's been run, hasn't, then run it.
Yep.
That is the most simple deployment model. And I like simple. Yeah. It's very easy to do things complicated. If you can keep it simple, so be it. And I think this is where the microservice, micro database approach comes in really well, is that if you start doing complex stuff, especially in your database, making the deployment becomes really hard. So there's some other tools for Gold Schema, so SQL Source Control from Redgate and the SQL CI package, SQL Server Data Tools, which is the Microsoft Visual Studio tooling, which we're using today. And then there's the migrations approach. If you're writing code first in Entity Framework, then that's essentially migrations. Migrations also has a challenge in terms of if you're working on branches. And then there's ReadyRoll. And ReadyRoll does a bit of a gold schema and migrations in that you can define your stored procs as gold stored procs because you can delete a stored proc and just put a new stored procedure in the database. And so it'll do that for code, but for your actual database, it will do the sort of incremental migration approach. So you talked about, the one thing I would say, no tool can solve all the problems. And I think this is where DevOps has evolved over the past years. It's so much easier now because most platforms, products have some DevOps story, but especially in the data land, so SIS, SSRS, analysis services, these things were written like 8, 9, 10 years ago. So DevOps wasn't even born then, wasn't even a twinkle in someone's eye. And so what that means is that some of these have little quirks and pain points. You have to be prepared to step out of the tool and go and do some other things. T-SQL isn't the solution for everything, and so you need some
other way to manipulate these databases.
Yeah, one of the examples is certificates aren't supported in SSDT, in SQL Server Data Tools, and so you have to deploy those manually. And certificates, if you want to have, so if you've ever worked in a PCI environment, there's this thing called duality, which means that two people have to own the key or right. have to know parts of the key, so that I can't just go and get the data from the database. I know the key, and so I can go and decrypt all the data. If you have half it and I have half it, we've got to collude to go and, yeah. And the view is that that's a lot safer. So to do that, you've got to go and manage it yourself. And so, really, if all else fails, turn to PowerShell.
Okay, even with data.
Even with data. I'm not a fan of the SQL PS stuff in PowerShell, but anything you can really do in PowerShell, it's just so powerful. I think if you're a DBA out there and looking at this, then you need to understand another language. PowerShell, I'd say, would be your starting point.
And what would you use the PowerShell to do? Give me an example of a sort of task that you carry out.
All sorts. I think one of the things to understand is when you look at build and deploy, almost every build and deploy framework, whether it's TeamCity, Octopus, VSTS with build and release, PowerShell is very native in there.
Yeah.
So deleting files, creating users, creating logins, creating folders on the file system, going off and adding firewall rules, adding things that aren't natively supported in the product, you can go and do it in PowerShell. And one of the things that's been released by the SQL Server Data Tools is a NuGet package for the SSDT tools.
Okay.
Now you might think, well, so what? Well, if we think about, so change is hard because I've got to understand who is working with me to manage that contract between you. Now, if you have a build server with 20 teams using that build server, and you've got to manage the tools on that build server. So if you want to use the latest version of SSDT and I want to use an old version, it's like, well,
got a problem.
If you've got 20 teams and you've got to coordinate that, that becomes really, really problematic. So there's a move lately, which is to move to isolated tools. So as someone that writes a build for my system, I can be responsible for the tools I want. I can download them and have them local to my build, so essentially X copy, not stored in the GAC or anything like that. No environment variable, global environment variables, no global anything. So I'm isolated from everyone else. If I want to go and run at 100 miles an hour, take the latest previews of everything, I can do that very easily with this. And so, back to your point about what you can do in PowerShell, download the latest tools,
okay.
Put them in place, set some paths, all those things to make it work. So you also mentioned data movement, and data movement is probably the hardest point about databases. Yeah, if you could just do an X copy of your database, it would be great. Yeah, but you can't because you've got this data thing. I'm very interested to see where containers go in that world. It'd be nice to be able to separate out your code from your sort of data storage so that you can very easily do an X copy of your database. But I think that's a
few, another day.
A few years off. And so data movement is hard because, I mean, as an example, you've got V1 of your product, you store your customer's address and their name in the same table. And then V2, you decide, actually we need their shipping address, their postal address, their, I don't know, their mum's address, whatever. And so you want to separate that into more tables. And so you've got to move that data. Now, if you've got 10 rows, that movement's going to be pretty quick. But if you've got a million rows, that's going to be quite slow. And do you want to move that data during your release? At what point does the application start working? If you're doing the background and you copy data in bulk from one table to another, SQL Server has this thing called locking and can end up blocking. And so you've got to consider how you're going
to
do things.
I guess it's key to have some sort of backwards compatibility built into your application as well, so it works with the old version of data.
Absolutely. And I think backwards compatibility, managing contracts, all those things that everyone thinks about from an application perspective, you have to think about from a database perspective. I think the other thing about data movement is my experience has said that it goes wrong. Yeah. I mean, if we're working on a vanilla system that's like 2 months old, you're probably not going to have much duff data in your production system. But what ends up happening is for older systems, you had the bugs, you had all these little issues that caused odd data to be in the wrong state in the production system. And so what ends up happening is you write this data movement and then you get to production and you realize that due to some bug, some field wasn't filled in, and then that causes your data movement script to fail.
It's a lot more complicated than, say, infrastructure, where you start from a clean slate every time. You can't just get rid of your data and start again.
No, you can't. And so you've got to be able to manage that. And so the point about that rework is that you need a pipeline that can keep reapplying and keep retrying, so a developer can make a change and reapply the thing. So you've got a few options with data movement. So we talked about the fact that if you're taking this customer address table, for instance, and you move it over, what you could do is you could not move it. So you could let your app go, okay, so I say I had two new tables. So if I go to, so imagine this, this is the situation where I have my service, and what I do is I have a single service boundary, and so I let my service boundary is my application and my database. And in this situation, my app understands that I've made this refactor and the data might not be there. And what it then does is that the app will read from the two different tables. If it doesn't exist in my new table, the app can then go and populate it. And so this is a very sort of eventual, consistent approach where the migration is occurring periodically.
And I guess it's more efficient in a way because you're not going to have high processing waiting for all this data to be migrated. It's just going to happen as and when it needs to.
As and when it's needed. What it also means is that the responsibility is in the application owner, the developers.
I guess that's a DBA trying to get
out. So they can manage it. Well, I think this is the point, is that you want the team that are developing the app to understand that.
Which is the key behind DevOps.
Yeah. And absolutely, the dev in the DevOps. And it also means that if the application needs to do some more complex logic to go and figure out how to populate this new data, it can do that. And it's often easier to write that complex logic in the app than it is to write this. I mean, I've seen massive complex bits of SQL to migrate data. Yeah. And if we think about what we said before about prone to bugs and data inconsistencies, it's a lot easier to have the app handle that on a piecemeal basis and start reporting them and deal with it, rather than you run your deployment and it then fails when you get to production halfway through because your big single insert has failed. So that's one approach, and that's a great approach when you've got this service DB boundary that you can wrap. Now, often for legacy systems, you don't know what data, what applications are talking to you as a database.
Yep.
Now, because of that, your database needs to manage its boundaries. And so you can do that with some complex stuff within the database, views and triggers and stuff. But in this situation, essentially, the app is talking to the tables, and behind the scenes, the database is syncing that data. And at some point, you can say, OK, the data is now in sync, and you can tell applications they can now go and access sort of V2 with this new table. And the database can still maintain it, because you might have some apps talking to just the one table and some apps talking to the new table. So versioning is a pretty poor story when you come to databases. I can't talk to version one of my schema or version two of my schema. Although you can do that a lot easier if you do procedures. So if you've got stored procedures that wrap your tables, it's a lot easier to write insert customer V1 and insert customer V2, and then have your apps talk to those. And then those stored procedures can do whatever logic to manage the existence of the different tables. So if you think about that, all we're doing is managing the service boundary and the contracts between the database and the application. So we're just thinking about our database as just being this application, really. It's just a service. So what we're going to show in the demo is we've got an insecure app which has been storing credit cards, and it's been storing them in clear text.
Tut tut.
We all know we've got lots of those, and we don't know which applications are talking to this database. So we're going to do the model where the database is responsible for the change, and we need to encrypt the data, and without breaking these contracts to the application. So the contracts we have in place that we know we're going to support are the app is inserting directly into this table, and also the app is selecting from this table, because it's doing a select from the card table where the card number is X to know whether to insert it or not to insert it. And so we need to manage those. So our target solution is that we have data is stored encrypted in the table. We have we changed our credit card table to be a view. We then use an instead of trigger, which is an ability to have a trigger on a view. So if someone writes an insert to a view, rather than the view trying to insert it into the tables underneath it, the instead of trigger does the logic. So it's a bit like the stored procedure wrapping what goes on. And we're going to use SQL Server cell encryption for that. Now, the challenge is the fact that we've already got lots of data.
Yep, it's not just new data.
It's not encrypted. So how do we do the data movement of that to encrypt it? For a period of time, we'll have encrypted and unencrypted data, because we want to do this online. We don't want to do this offline.
We don't want downtime.
Now, some people will argue that, well, surely your data is, you need to get your data encrypted to be satisfied with your happiness. So, yeah, but as with any of these things, there is a road to get to where you want to get to. You can't just go from zero to hero immediately. You've got to get on that road. And we need to query on the card number. So one of the interesting things, if we encrypt the card number table, the card number, and someone does select from card where card number is X, the only way SQL Server is going to be able to find that out is to decrypt every single card, try and find the match, and then that's going to obviously...
Be interested to see the solution to that one. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, so there is an interesting one. So what we're going to do is, so that's essentially the before and after. Before and after is very simple. And after we've got this insert into a view and the magic behind triggers and an encrypted table. So we have a little app which is currently been running. So this is running against SQL Azure. And we have a number of builds that are configured in Visual Studio Online.
I hope they're not real credit card numbers flying past.
Everything's a real
no
credit
comment.
Card number.
But,
so what we have is three different branches of code just to manage the different different stages of change. We've already deployed our master one, and what we'll do is we will get off and deploy our middle one. So this is going to do our first stage, which is going to make a first set of changes. So we should see our release has started. So we've got a BVT environment and then we've got a production environment. So we're deploying to two different environments just to simulate dev and test. And this is pointing our production system. So the change we're going to make is we're going to rename the table so we don't lose the data. So that's then going to become our encrypted table. We're going to then create a view that points to that table. Now, the nice thing about those is they are metadata changes, and so metadata changes are pretty instant, pretty online. And one of the really nice things about SQL Server is that they are making more and more changes, sort of no-op metadata changes, adding defaults, those type of things. And so in this case, the app is going to insert into the cart, into the view, and that's just going to go and insert direct and select from the table. Now, to support the querying and to support the encryption, what we're going to do is we are going to add some extra columns to that table. We need to know whether the card has been encrypted or not, and we also need to know the mask. And this is how we're going to solve the querying for credit card numbers. What we're going to do is we're going to go and add a mask, which is unencrypted, which is essentially the first bit and the last bit of the card number. Essentially, you know the receipt you get on a till that shows part of your card number? That's it. And so what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to store those in clear text. Now, that means that generally, on most production systems, if you query based on that, you'll get 10 or 11 rows back, and then you can decrypt.
Got you. Makes sense. That's the last 10. My question.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the challenges is we need to make sure that our app can manage this, and so you might have seen, if you're observant, the little V2 flag here. So I've already told my app developers that I'm going to make this change, and so at some point when I've deployed this change, I need you to go and pass the card mask in, and then the system will work.
So at the moment, the application is inserting into the unencrypted.
So it is inserting into our card table, and if we go and look, let's see where we got to. So what we'll see is our card table has now got data in it, and our card encrypted. So our card encrypted table has been deployed. If we go back to here, what we should find. Oh. So what's happening is that the card encrypted table has been deployed, but I need to populate the mask.
Yeah.
And so gradually, what will happen is that card mask will get populated.
And that's a task in your release pipeline
Task in my release pipeline that's doing it. It's at the end, so there's the gold schema bit and then there's a post-deployment bit at the end, which is going off and doing that, populating the card mask. My system is online, and you'll see that it didn't skip a beat. There were no errors when I was doing the deployment. Eventually, what I should find is that if it can catch up,
see if it's done any.
Yep. So it should have done some. So here we've got our card mask. So clearly I've been running this for a little while, so that's why it's got quite a bit of data to go. So now we've got that, what I can do is, once that's finished, I'll be able to turn on my V2 flag. So the next change we want to make is we want to go and actually do the encryption part. So let me just minimize that. We can handle an instead of trigger, and what happens here is that the data gets inserted into the card view and the instead of trigger fires. That's going to use some keys and some certificates, which we've managed within the release manager pipeline, and that is going and then populating the encrypted data. So hopefully that has finished.
Right,
so what I'll do is I'll kick off this one.
Must have a lot of data in there.
Demo gods.
Oh, there we go.
That's finished. So now I can turn on the V2 flag, and that's going to be now querying based on card mask. And my final one is kicking off, and all that's doing is deploying these changes. So the instead of trigger, inserting into the columns, and the key and the certificate. And if we look at our app just for a second, this was my V2 change. So is V2 passing the card mask?
Got you.
Otherwise. And I think this is one of the big points about change is you need to manage that. You need to articulate and work with your developer teams or your to say, this is your V2 of your system. You need to do this to make this work. So if we go and back and look at our release. So that's now gone into development, and hopefully in a minute. So let's just look at what our pipeline looks like.
I was going to say, let's see what's actually going on.
So
PowerShell.
And the reason this is PowerShell is that I want to do a little bit more than the built-in DAC deployment stuff. And one of my pet peeves about the this build thing is that if we just...
It's not enough room in the box.
There is not enough room in this box to write anything.
I had 10 parameters on an ARM template last week, and it was like, I need more room. I'm going to have words with people and see if we can get that.
Oh, absolutely. Now, a couple of nice things. If you use meta tasks and you reference variables, then what ends up happening is those variables become variables in the meta task, which means you then get a box per variable, which works quite nicely. Now the other thing, and this comes back to what I was saying about the using a PowerShell script, is any variable that you specify here or any variable that you specify in your environment variables are passed through as environment variables, as in sort of env colon, which means you can then use them in your script. And if we look at our script, we have, that's not the wrong one. Let me just fire this up. So this app has been running. Let's just go and see if we've got any encrypted data. So now we've got our encrypted data and our card number is blank.
So is it blanking as it encrypts, it blanks the card number?
It's just not even storing it. Okay. So
these are new inserts.
So these are new inserts. And we will then still need to do a bit that goes and says, re-encrypt the data that hasn't been encrypted. But the system is now working. The system is handling. If I go and do this, the card number is being passed back, decrypted, because I've got access to the certificate that encrypted it. If I didn't have access, I wouldn't be able to see it. So that is all nicely secure. And the app just carried on working. Now if we just look at the script, so this is my script. And one of the things that we do is I always ensure that we have a script that enables a developer to simulate the build in VSTS.
Yep.
So this is what happens in VSTS, and it calls the deploy script, and then the deploy goes and does this script. Takes in a load of variables defaults to the environment variables, i.e. the ones that I set as variables, so I don't actually have to pass them in, which makes it a lot nicer. And it outputs them all, so I get a nice log in my release log. What I also do is I do this bit of code. I'm sure there's an easier way. There's always a million and one ways of doing stuff in PowerShell.
There was somebody watching go, why have you done it that way?
Yes. But what this does is, if we go into here, I am creating a JSON document, sticking it in a deployment table, and what this has is all the environment variables that were used as part of the release, and all the PowerShell variables that are passed in, which means I've got some really great traceability. If someone hacks about with my database, I know that they've done it via a deploy, or if someone manually tries to do it, then...
What about rolling back?
Don't roll back.
Don't roll back. Don't so roll make back. Sure you do it right. Don't First time back. Test.
So in production, you don't need to roll back. Yeah. You should have gone through enough stages to be able to not roll back in production. If you're rolling back, you're going to have more problems trying to roll back and trying to build rollback in your process than you are being agile enough to fix it moving forward. And you should have had enough stages in your pipeline to verify it. Now, what I also say is that in your dev and test, in your pipeline, one of those stages or many of those stages need to restore from a known point. So you need to restore your system to a production-like version. Because one of the challenges is you make a change, I make a change, you make a change. Now, unless you're like level 5 on sort of DevOps maturity, those changes are going to get batched in some form. And what that means is that two changes might go to test, another two changes might go to test, and then when it goes to prod or goes to UAT, four changes might be batched together. And so you have slightly different behaviors. And so in those in a couple of those environments, pre-prod or UAT, restore to the same point as production so that you know your upgrade is going to actually do what it's going to do. And crucially, if you have a data movement piece going on, that's when having a live-like volume of data so that you understand that, and a live-like production of data and a system that's testing when you're deploying, so that you understand the impact of doing your deployment whilst you're doing your deployment is crucial.
Yeah, because you don't want a big performance hit while you're modifying your data.
I've had far too many clients have serious outages, and when you have problems, people start sort of, it's like headless chooks running around going, oh, and so you end up making the wrong decision.
And someone says, I've got a script, and I run that script, and it causes more damage than...
And the rollback thing's fascinating. I find it interesting that people say, oh, we've got this really strong release process that is very stringent, lots of checks and balances. Yet, when something goes wrong in live, like, anything's up. It's like, we'll just deploy this script, and it's like, well, that's in the most crucial time when things are really up against it and you're deploying sort of hacky changes. It's like one of the really interesting features of Release Manager is that if I go into a release, you can go into the instances of a release, and so this is my release, and I can go into this, and I can actually edit this release.
That version of the release. And I actually sometimes get confused. I'm thinking I'm editing my release definition, but I'm actually just editing that version.
Yes.
And then I do another deployment of the release, and the same error's there. I'm like, but I've just fixed that and saved it. Where's it gone? But it's because I've edited that specific release rather than the overall definition.
Yes. And I feel it's a bit of an anti-pattern. I've very much seen, if you've got like four pipelines or four stages in your environment, and you get to the last one and you've not set an environment variable, you've not set a variable correctly, do you need to really push from start all the way through? Now, my argument is, you really should. Yeah. But there is also, I would like them to have a better story, yeah. which is, like, you do get to see, so if yeah. you made a change, you get to see it in the history, yeah. but there's yeah. no way of automatically applying
it. I did one the other night, I made a change, got the release to deploy, went to bed, next morning it was failing. Yeah. Because I'd edited it just on that version, oh, yeah. so the next one that was committed failed.
Yeah, I've done that lots of times.
So I'm now aware enough to look out for it.
Yes, so so lots of little aspects there, yeah. and our release has now gone through, and our app has been running, and we will eventually re-encrypt the data that's existing. Now the other aspect is key management and certificates. We can do another deployment, change the keys, and so we end up with a nice key rotation story as well. And then finally, remove. So we had the case to handle the fact that we had encrypted and unencrypted data. Now that's a bit of legacy code, yep. And so we want to remove that. You've got to put scaffolding up. So if you want to change the wings on a plane, yeah, you've got to put some scaffolding up to make those changes. You can't just remove them. Yeah.
It's not. It's not just all a one-step process. It's got to be. It's like, you know, build up to the change, make the change, and then yeah. clear up afterwards.
It's like asking your builder to sort of build the outside or build two floors on your house without putting some scaffolding up. You've got to put this stuff in place to allow you to make the change, but be prepared to remove it afterwards.
I think that's part of the issue. A lot of people I work with and talk to expect we have to do it and just make it, have a step that
yes.
does it, but actually it's a whole new release process.
Yes.
Just for the data.
And changes, I was talking to Stephen this morning, managing change is probably the most complex thing, and I think that's where, as an engineer, you trying to minimise all the influences you have on your system means you can reduce the amount of change, that you're, the impact of your change, and so you can run a lot quicker. So, in summary, I think complex changes are possible, but you have to think about them. You break it into smaller changes, smaller chunks that aren't manageable in their entirety. And you can test them as they're going along. I mean, Daniel was talking about testing stuff. We could very easily have put testing in that pipeline to make sure that all the backwards compatibility. People are talking about sort of customer-driven contracts, customer-driven testing. It's like, test what the customers are going to be using, and then you can make sure you have managed those contracts. And also, contracts aren't necessarily those just well-defined things about five columns or your interface looks like X. It's also some of the behaviours in that contract. So the fact that we needed to pass card masks, it became required. Some of those things you've got to think about. But from a database perspective, as with all DevOps, you've got to define some rules to make it work. Breaking changes, they're a no-go. You also need to write scripts that are backwards and, interestingly, forwards compatible. So if you do SSDT and essentially you have gold schema and you have post-deployment, essentially your post-deployment needs to work with all versions of the gold schema. So someone will add 10 columns after you, but you're when you actually do that deployment, your script will run after those columns have been added.
Yep.
So you have to be very careful. So things like select star are really bad. They're bad anyway. and give developers the ownership of the process. If you let them own it, they'll make it what it is, but they can then fix it. If you're having DBAs in that process outside of the team, then that whole breaks the agile DevOps mind. Mantra,
so the the steps and things that we've talked about in this session, do you see that as something that devs will take on and do with a bit of advice from DBAs, or who owns that process within a DevOps team?
So I think the team needs to own it. I don't think many DBAs have got the knowledge as well. So that's what we do as a company. We go and help teams that need to have this capability. And I think once you give them the basics, then they can really pick it up and run with it.
Okay. And if you want to go and learn more about this sort of thing, data and DevOps, anywhere you'd recommend?
So I've got a blog, sqlblogcast.com/blogs/Simon, search for Simon Sabin. There's some good meetups to to search for SQL. There's a guy called Ed Elliott who runs the Agile SQL Club. He's got some great stuff on that as well. So, yeah, ping me if you've got any questions, and good luck.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks,
Marcus.
Okay,
thank you. We're going to take another 15-minute break, and after the break, we're going to have Elton come and talk about Windows containers and Docker.